I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
Hold it, hold it, hold it. Bin Laden is dead. Bin Laden is dead. Happy days. Happy days, everybody. This is the greatest.
After years of painstaking work by our intelligence community, I was briefed on a possible lead to bin Laden.
Officials found bin Laden by tracking his longtime trusted courier.
It was far from certain, and it took many months to run this thread to ground.
The last thing Osama bin Laden saw on this earth was a small team of Americans who shot him.
Justice has been done.
Through the fog of war, the cover stories in Hollywood versions, the myths and emotion, comes eventually, when you least expect it, a pinpoint of light, a clarifying detail. Seymour Hersh has provided just one of those sparks in his report 4 years later on the killing of Osama bin Laden, the satanic villain in the epic of 9/11. So how is to absorb and apply the news that the muscular Muslim power most closely involved with the United States in the war on terror, that is Pakistan, gave safe harbor for the last 5 years of his life to our public enemy number one, the man we blamed for igniting the war on terror? We're getting our heads around one instance of double dealing at the heart of a lethally bad marriage, a misalliance of military powers covering up their conflicting interests. The polite name for it is the double game inside the great game of strategy across the bridge between Europe and Asia, a game spiraling down for a decade now toward chaos. We begin with the New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall, who spent 15 years on the Afghan and Pakistan wars. We asked her to remember the first call she got that Osama bin Laden was dead. She spoke to us from her New Times dateline, Tunis.
So we come to 2011, and one day my editor calls me and says, I think bin Laden's been killed, and turn on your television, and I watch President Obama telling the tale. And then I'm in Kabul, and I jump on a plane and get to Pakistan. And so finally, after following this man, chasing him, looking for him, wondering where in the mountains he is, although I always knew he was in Pakistan, you know, that's what my journalistic instinct always told me. It was amazing to suddenly find that he'd been tracked down and killed in a suburban house just yards from Pakistan's top military academy in this beautiful hill town of Abbottabad. And there he'd been living, it turned out, for I think the best part of 5 years. So for me, the most fascinating thing was then to track how he'd managed to live there undercover or in what circumstances. And for the last 4 years, it has absorbed me because, you know, the details have come out slowly. They've often been contradicted. Even the very first details of the raid were corrected and pointed out. Both America and Pakistan have been at loggerheads, partly over the details, and they've sort of leaked bits. And then there was this extreme anger that we as journalists on the scene, you know, encountered among the Pakistani military. How could America come and get slipped through their radar? They looked now very vulnerable to any attack from India because they'd been all sleeping, or had they been in the know and let it happen? It's so the mysteries goes on and on. And now we have Seymour Hersh coming out, turning a lot of the presumed accounts, and certainly the accounts from the government, the American government, he's turned them all upside down. So we're not there yet on getting to the bottom of the matter, but I think we're getting closer.
And what difference does it make? How does it change the story to know that the ISI, the Pakistan Army Intelligence, knew he was there, was shepherding him in a way?
The main thing is that Pakistan has been behind the Taliban insurgency and has been giving safe haven to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda have been in the tribal areas along the mountains the whole time since they were pushed out of Afghanistan in 2001. And we knew bin Laden and his deputies, Zawahiri, and many of his senior lieutenants were at large in Pakistan. And so people would tell me, whether they were members of the Taliban or villagers living in the tribal areas or Afghans who were fighting them, that bin Laden was there somewhere and was probably under protection. And the basis of it is that Pakistan found it useful to have him. They were protecting him, but both controlling him or constraining him in some way. You know, he's a great figurehead. I think they didn't want to be the ones responsible for killing him or be seen to be capturing him. So they wanted him out of sight, but safe. In other words, you know, they didn't want him bombed in a cave by the Americans, so they kept him safe somewhere and hidden. And I think what's very interesting is you see in some of the correspondence that was found in the compound and has come to light that bin Laden never trusted the Pakistanis. He always warned his fighters to beware of Pakistan. So I think he always perhaps knew one day he would be betrayed, that they only were using him, you know, while he was useful or while he could work with them. But you also saw in the letters and in a report that I uncovered from 2009 that he didn't ever believe in what he called attacking the mothership. He saw Pakistan as a safe haven, as a country that was on the same lines as him. And he exhorted his followers not to attack Pakistan and to always direct their attacks towards American forces in Afghanistan or to the Western world and to Afghanistan rather than Pakistan. And so in that sense, he was on the same wavelength as the Pakistani intelligence services. So one intelligence officer years ago told me he was a protege of Pakistan. Right from the beginning, when he first came as a young man to join the Mujahideen and to offer help, and he ran a guest house and he helped build camps for the Mujahideen and he sponsored a lot of international jihadis. From those days when I think he was genuinely moved by the plight of the Afghans and wanted to help. And then he became more and more political. And I think he was deeply influenced by Ayman al-Zawahiri and the Egyptians, who were very radical already. And then he turned his ire against America as the great evil power that he saw was supporting the Arab governments that he didn't agree with, essentially, and that he saw the Western backing of those governments as the biggest problem. And so that's why he turned obsessively to try and attack America. And I think the Pakistanis perhaps didn't mind that he was always aiming his attacks to America. They saw him as something useful for their own reasons. And that's what's astonishing, that they could be an ally, a major non-NATO ally, after all, you know, winning billions of dollars over this last decade from America, and yet they could be hiding the top target of the American war. The whole aim of the war was to catch bin Laden and to break al-Qaeda. And so that I think is the most incredible detail of all these stories. And Seymour Hersh, he brings another angle to it, but that's the crux of his story, and it's really the crux of my story last year in the New York Times Magazine, which was that Pakistan was playing this extraordinary game of fighting a war on both sides.
Carlotta Gold, that begins to make some wonderful sense. I mean, Osama is loyal to Pakistan, he's their protege, but Pakistan is a protege of the United States power too, not particularly loyal, but this thing begins to come full circle. It's only confusing because we never admit what the United States is up to here. I mean, you say Pakistan is playing a game, but the United States is playing a game too, which is treat Pakistan as the main general contractor of violence, the army, the weapons in the region. But Pakistan then has its own subcontractors of violence, and things get out of control. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Yes, I think that's, you know, certainly America, I think that was a mistaken policy to subcontract, as it were, the Afghan war, and so blindly to accept Pakistan's way of doing things. I was told that that was a result of Vietnam, that the military and the administration didn't want Americans involved on the ground against the Russians. But by subcontracting out a war, yes, you get all the complications that of lack of control and lack of eyesight on things. But you have to choose your allies right, and you have to also, I think, take responsibility for the aftermath. And I think that's where there was a great failure by America, is not to look after Afghanistan or help Afghanistan rebuild after the Russian invasion and you know, democratize and find a peaceful way to survive. But what really, really troubles me, because it became really clear in my 10, 12 years in Afghanistan and Pakistan, this last, since 9/11, was that America knew Pakistan was playing a double game for many years. And many administration and diplomatic officials didn't admit it to me, but I gradually realized they did know, and they were denying it. Okay, that's fine to deny it to a journalist for if they have security reasons, but they persisted with a policy that allowed Pakistan to just increase its involvement. And at what cost? I mean, you know, thousands of Western soldiers died, over 2,000 American soldiers died there. And by my count, tens of thousands of Afghans have died since 9/11, since 2001. And that, I think, was unnecessary. The length and the horror of this war in Afghanistan was not necessary. And I think a lot of that happened on America's watch when they knowingly were not confronting Pakistan about its involvement and stopping it. And meanwhile, were funding billions of dollars to the Pakistani military. And that very strange, double-handed policy is very weird and, I think, to be condemned.
That was Carlotta Gall, who now covers North Africa for The New York Times. Coming up, two Pakistani perspectives on the price their country has paid for an off-and-on partnership with the United States. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. New light on the death of Osama bin Laden illuminates the dark corners of an era. Our guest, Muhammad Idris Ahmad, lived it. Growing up in Peshawar, in Pakistan, he watches it closely now, teaching and writing in Scotland. He is the author of The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War.
Let me describe a rather stark scene. When I was growing up in Peshawar, there used to be an American cultural center in Peshawar. And that's one of the places where I got exposed to American literature and culture. And the thing that I remember most about it is never having seen, in all its years of existence, never having seen a security guard outside guarding anything, because nobody ever thought that there's anything to guard here, that anybody from the United States would ever be under threat. Things have changed, obviously, now, because if you go to Peshawar, so there's an American consulate there, and it's fortified by several embankments, pickets, then you have armored personnel carriers, and then many soldiers guarding it, and it still gets attacked. So obviously the dynamic has shifted in a very major way. It's a very different country than the one that I grew up in. When I go back, I'm obviously struck by the level of insecurity. In fact, the last time I was there, which was this December, was shortly after there had been this massacre in a school. 153 children had been pretty much executed. That's a military school. So that was something which shook even Peshawar. Peshawar, which even over the past 12 years of conflict, it has endured much. But regardless of that, there was an attitude that life goes on, and if you just stay out of certain places, you'll be safe. So what's happening, I mean, obviously what's happening next door has affected all of this. And the drone strikes are another irritant, which have also contributed a lot to the insecurity, because most of the drone strikes don't hit anybody who is actually wanted. So there are a lot of civilian casualties. But in the instances where somebody of importance is struck, which is a very minor instance, actually it's 2% of the time. So what happens then is that the retaliation, it doesn't, obviously it can't hit the United States. It comes on Peshawar, it comes on Islamabad, it comes on Lahore. So we are affected by a war in which we have actually no say and to which we haven't acquiesced. So obviously what the US is doing next door is affecting us. So that clearly shows that this alliance is dysfunctional.
Let's talk about this, you say dysfunctional alliance. I want to know from a son of Pakistan what it's done to your country. And I want your observation on what it reveals about us.
What happens is that in Pakistan, when it's at its birth, it inherited all of British India's security challenges, but it inherited a very small amount of British India's resources. So what happened is it needed external help. And so it turned to the United States, but they gave crumbs. So they were very unhappy about that. So that's where the dysfunction was born, because Pakistan realized that it's just getting the short end of the stick. So what it would do is that it would do the minimal possible to justify these alliances without ever putting its own interests at risk. And it went on like that. And 1980s was the first time when the interests directly converged, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Right. So that 80s cooperation, that was sort of like the high point in the relations between Pakistan and the US. But that also collapsed in 1989, just as soon as the Soviets withdrew. That's when suddenly the American investment in the region also declined. And in fact, soon afterwards, the US put massive sanctions on Pakistan because of its pursuit of nuclear weapons. And what also happened is that even the cultural assistance, you know, the American center suddenly was shut down. So not only that the United States disengaged, but it also forfeited the soft power it had. And consequence of that was that Pakistanis really started to resent this, that they felt used. And then it went on in the 90s. There was no love lost between the two. But then 9/11 happened, and suddenly this alliance was revived. The only thing was that they were supporting a military dictator who was actually, for his first few years, he was rather popular. But then what happened is, because of the alliance with the United States, his popularity also diminished and he started becoming more and more authoritarian. There's two ways in which Pakistan has been paying the price. One, there is the direct blowback, which affects Pakistan's own security.
Meaning?
Meaning that when the United States carries out its attack in the Fatah region. So these people, then they strike back inside Pakistan, because all of Pakistan is sort of open to them, that they can strike in any part of Pakistan. Pakistan doesn't have enough resources, a huge country. It can deploy troops everywhere. So as soon as it protects one region, the focus of the terrorist attack shifts to another one. And same thing happened with Pakistani military, because Pakistani military also started carrying out these operations, and these were really brutal operations, most of them. And a lot of civilians got displaced and a lot of civilians got killed. So the sort of dynamic started spiraling, that you had greater hostility. And then Pakistani troops started being attacked. Now, this is the thing that people forget, that Pakistan now has lost more soldiers than any other when it comes to fighting the war on terror of any partner of the United States. That's the dynamic that people conveniently forget.
More than
the US, more than Britain, more than any of the countries which are currently engaged in Afghanistan. We are talking about over 10,000 soldiers. Obviously, there's a resentment about that, too, that Pakistan is embroiled in a war which is not exactly its own. And then at the same time, in terms of the manpower that has been committed to this war, it has been ruining it during the Musharraf years. You know, that even again, when you compare that to the amount of aid that it was receiving from the United States, there was no way that even on economic grounds you could justify that. So it's not a question of unilateral perfidy. Here has been a case of both Pakistan and the United States using each other, except in the case of Pakistan, the using has been done mostly by very unscrupulous politicians and mainly by the military. So the country has not reaped any benefits of this alliance with the United States. So because of that, the image of the United States is not exactly what it used to be in the 80s or 90s.
Consider the entirely different views, Idris, that the United States has of Afghanistan and Pakistan has of Afghanistan. For Pakistan, it seems that Afghanistan is sort of the backwoods where India can make trouble. We saw it and acted because of the Soviet invasion. Could these purposes, these visions, ever be allied?
They can be reconciled if Pakistan's very deep-seated sense of insecurity is allayed. And the United States hasn't helped there because, you know, just recently, United States was giving nuclear technology to India, its main rival. So when you have a region in which the balance of power is already very delicate, so when you do something like that, you create even greater resentments.
So what's the lesson for us Americans going forward, as citizens and our government?
Well, the key thing is just to not look at the world as a big security problem. I mean, you know, that's the old sort of a cliche about when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So the United States having the biggest military in the world, it looks at everything as a security issue. And it should look at things from a more of a humanitarian perspective. I mean, it has the resources, it has the potential goodwill of people. You know, everybody comes to any part of the world because of the U.S. cultural power, that you can't escape American television, you can't escape American pop culture, you can't escape American literature. So people are very much exposed to that. America almost feels like, you know, something that you are very familiar with in a way that you aren't with many other countries in the world or many other big powers. So the United States potentially has all this goodwill that it could tap into. But as long as it sees all the world as a security issue, carrying its big hammer, it's only going to generate resentments. And we are seeing the consequences of that, you know, across a whole region.
That was the journalist and historian Mohammed Idris Ahmad in Scotland. Aisha Jalal is among the foremost historians of Pakistan. From its damaging birth in 1947 by partition from a united India under British rule, Aisha Jalal teaches at Tufts University in the States. We reached her by Skype in her home in Lahore, which is the cultural capital of Pakistan in the Punjab.
So Pakistan has actually had an operational relationship with the United States at times, and with the possible exception of the war against the Soviet Union's occupation of Afghanistan, they have their own national security interests, and those interests don't match. But Pakistan has nevertheless provided operational cooperation and support to the United States.
An operational relationship sounds like a loveless marriage, which can be an abusive marriage.
Well, it can also be a very useful one if both serve their purposes and still have a plausible deniability with their respective publics. So it's a relationship where the other one's interests don't agree with your ideological protestations, and yet you are in an operational relationship in order to achieve practical needs. And I think that becomes a very useful relationship.
How does Pakistan's history and its relation with the United States over many years combine to produce this war on terror, which begins to look like an endless disaster?
Well, I mean, I think the roots really do go back to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the front put up through Pakistan to fight this Soviet occupation. And that meant that, I mean, Saudi Arabia sent off 1,200 angry, radicalized young men to fight in Afghanistan. So it sorted out Saudi Arabia's problem, but created Pakistan, I mean, a kind of a cockpit of radical ideologies, all manner of intelligence agencies, all of that. I mean, I would say that despite all the talk about it having been born in blood and being Islamic and all that, it was a fairly sort of moderate secular country as much as you can get. Of course, Islam was very important, but so too is it important in many other countries that are by and large secular. Things changed dramatically in the 80s. For one thing, the support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan brought in huge amounts of greenbacks from the United States of America that were matched dollar for dollar by the Saudis. And that was a huge amount of money, and that did finance madrasas with preaching some conservative to radical ideologies. And it did lead eventually to the emergence of the Taliban to some extent. So I think those are factors that have played a role in the radicalization of Pakistan. That's what I would say. I mean, Pakistan was by and large moderate, and what one sees now is, unfortunately, has to do with that legacy.
How does a country get de-radicalized?
Well, first by accepting that it has a problem, which took a long time, and there are still questions of how deeply Pakistan accepts the problem. The constant denial of the problem within has led things to this pass, very sorry pass, I might add. Pakistan has a long way to go in handling this problem. It's a very deep problem, and it's widespread, and it needs, I mean, the institutions of the state are very weak and non-functional. So a lot of that has to happen. It's about administrative governance to a large extent as well, I must say. But things are not easy handling Pakistan. And at any rate, I think China comes as a potential partner for Pakistan with great hope and promise. And maybe that will be hopefully a stabilizing factor. And let's see what there is in the offing. That's an optimistic reading. One could be cynical, and the doubts are there too. I mean,
so the optimistic hope coming out of the United States' relationship with Pakistan is China, really.
Yes, China is the optimistic note in Afghanistan as well, in the sense that the U.S. doesn't have the kind of commitment to give Afghanistan the money that it needs. The Chinese private capital in particular would. So that's an interesting dimension. So we'll have to wait and see, Chris, what happens.
That was Ayesha Jalal in Lahore, her hometown. Her latest book is The Pity of Partition, featuring her great uncle, one of the great writers of in Urdu of Pakistan, the short story genius Manto. My studio guest is Dean of the School of Global Studies at Boston University. Adil Najam was effectively the head of Pakistan's leading university in Lahore. Welcome.
Thank you.
Adil, speak to that last point from Ayesha Jalal that Pakistan's best friend looking forward could well be China, with a very different definition of development.
Pakistanis certainly believe that. Not only do Pakistanis believe that China is Pakistan's best friend, they actually probably believe that China is now Pakistan's only friend.
Really?
Earlier, no one uses the word friend when talking about Pakistan. No one also uses the friend anymore when talking about Saudi Arabia, which would have been some years ago seen as, and that is because of what Ayesha said, the impact of the U.S. and Saudi money flowing into Pakistan in the 80s and the religiosity that it sprung and the violence that it sprung and actually even other social issues like drugs that it sprung has sort of distanced Pakistanis even from Saudi Arabia. So China is not only seen as Pakistan's only true friend. China might be seen by many Pakistanis as Pakistan's last hope.
China also is a friend that has on the drawing board plans for high-speed rail, not only into Pakistan, they probably have it to Paris, but also literally over the pole to Alaska and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I mean, there will be a concrete development scheme for Pakistan, and it won't be sort of whack-a-mole anti-terror games either.
No, it's money that will be seen, if spent, will be actually seen by people. So just look at the numbers, right? So we talk in the U.S. about our relationship with Pakistan. When we talk it numerically, we say $1 billion a year, right? And and we say it with pride as if it's a large number. What's the number that China just threw to Pakistan 2 weeks ago? $43 billion. When we spend our billion, where does it go? It goes essentially to the beltway around Washington.
Yes.
To a lot of consultants and contractors and sort of, you know, Halliburton and all sorts of things. Very few Pakistanis actually see too much of that 1 billion. USAID tries. It tries to put on the right ads. But the fact is the average Pakistani doesn't see where that billion is going because it's going to the terror issue. Now, the Chinese are coming and saying, we'll build you this grand road. We'll build you this grand port, which actually has been built. We'll build you this grand railway. Now, that's a very different – it's imperialism. Both of those are imperialism. This is something Pakistan understands, having lived with the British. But it's a very different type of imperialism. That China is promising to Pakistan than what the U.S. had been delivering.
I met a man in Islamabad. It turns out you know him well, Nadeem al-Haq. He was the development director for the government of Pakistan. And he said to me, first of all, we're the country that could blow up the world. But get rid of the weapons. Send us National Public Radio. Send us American libraries again. And we could have a real relationship. But I want you to speak to something I felt. I was there for most of a month a few years ago. Speak to the absurdity on its face in Afghanistan, in this relationship. It's clear, but nobody has to defend it, including Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State. Her roommate at Wellesley was a Pakistani. She knows much better than anything we're doing over there. So I think does John Kerry.
Yep.
What's to do about it?
Yeah. But both of them have very close advisors who are Pakistanis, and as do many Americans. This is an absurd relationship on both sides. And, you know, when I hear your guests earlier, your interviews earlier, or when I read Cy Hirsch's piece, one of the biggest things that hits me is that the big lesson is that this the Sighthurst story is the perfect metaphor, the perfect metaphor for the U.S.-Pakistan relationship and the absurdity of it. Why? A, because nothing that can be said or heard about it can or should be believed. You can believe no one, you can believe nothing, because someone will come with an equally absurd story which will equally make some sense because the lack of trust. You know, why are we having this debate in Sighthurst? Because there is such a depth of lack of trust that nothing that anyone can say, Hirsch or Obama or the Pakistan government or the U.S. government, that anyone will ever believe. And the second thing about it is that it is not a friendship. The point that you started with, right? That's what the Sighthurst story to me, it's not about the details. What he's really pointing out is, in stark ways, he's saying, this is why what you guys are calling it, it is not. It is not a friendship. It is not an alliance. So that's an equally big lie that this is an alliance. An alliance is much more transparent. I don't think U.S. ever, they might have designated Pakistan as an ally. I don't think they ever saw it, nor did the Pakistanis ever treat the U.S. as a real ally.
I came away thinking it's something like an illicit affair, more like a bad marriage, or even worse, an abusive marriage. They can't stop it, but they can't do real business either. Coming up, whose strategy really was this war on terror? This war that we're still fighting and losing on Al-Qaeda's turf. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, unspooling the familiar rationales for the global war on terror since 9/11. Fawaz Gerges at the London School of Economics is Lebanese by birth. He's a teacher of international relations and the biographer of Al-Qaeda, among other things. I asked him over Skype this week to help us see the through line of the era, from the fall of the trade towers in Manhattan to the spread of ISIS in Iraq and Syria today.
The story of America's global wars, it's not just a global war on terror, is really very tragic. It's very tragic because we could have witnessed a different story. Many Americans don't realize that at the height of its power on 9/11, this was not, you might say, a major global or civilizational attack against America. It was more of a security nuisance. They did inflict a great deal of damage and pain on America. But I would argue that American response to 9/11 produced unintended consequences, consequences that continue to be with us today. The war against Al-Qaeda Central was almost over by 2002. Al-Qaeda was almost defeated in 2002 in Afghanistan. It did not have a major base of support. It did not win the hearts and minds of Muslims. It was besieged and on the defensive. Its hundreds of fighters scattered and on the run. The world turned against Al-Qaeda, including the overwhelming majority of Muslim governments and Muslim public opinion. Yet, what did the United States do? Instead of trying to really use 9/11 as a catalyst to change the world for good, to use that painful moment, the attack against the American homeland, to remake the world in a positive way, to tell the world about the great values of America, the United States decided to wage a global war on terror designed to basically exact revenge.
It's so ironic. It's come to the point where a college student in Colorado has the nerve to tell Jeb Bush, your brother gave us ISIS. It's a long time realizing this.
Neither Al-Qaeda in Iraq nor ISIS would have seen the light of the day without the American-led invasion of Iraq and occupation of Iraq. The American-led invasion and occupation of Iraq not only provided a new lease of life for Al-Qaeda Central, for Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri, that was defeated in Afghanistan in 2002, but basically sowed the seeds of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and its successor, the so-called Islamic State. By destroying Iraqi institutions, by occupying a country that had nothing to do with 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, by putting in place a sectarian-based regime. In many ways, the United States provided Iraq on a silver platter to Al-Qaeda Central.
Professor Geragos, I mean, you could argue that if there is a strategic thread here, it's Al-Qaeda's, to draw out American fighting power into Osama's territory, so to speak.
That was exactly the strategy of Osama bin Laden and his second-in-command, Ayman Zawahiri, to attack the head of the snake. They called the United States the head of the snake. And their argument was, in the late 1990s, once we attack the United States of America, U.S. politicians would lash out angrily against the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim global community, and we, Al-Qaeda, would stand up and defend the Muslim community, and we would gain credibility in the eyes of Muslims worldwide. That was the template long before 9/11, and that's exactly how the neoconservative acted. And they hoped by lashing out against Saddam Hussein, they would bring about a domino theory effect, that when the United States toppled Saddam Hussein, both Iran and Syria would follow.
I think Americans are still hungry to know about the troubles of the Muslim world, but also the troubles of our own imperial management. What should we be learning about the world out there, but also ourselves?
Well, I think we need to be extremely cautious about the use of military force overseas. We are addicted when it comes to military power. We believe that all problems can be resolved by throwing military might at them. We must be very careful of how we deal with dictators. These dictators basically not only contribute or lead to extremism in their own countries, but basically embroil the United States in major difficult situations overseas, whether you're talking about Afghanistan, you're talking about Pakistan, you're talking about Saudi Arabia, you're talking about Iraq. I think the United States must take really a second look at its foreign policy and its military engagement throughout the world, particularly in the Middle East and the greater Muslim world.
Professor Geragos, you've lived here, taught here. You know this country well. What is it we're not getting?
I mean, I think when the history of the global wars on terror is written in 30 or 40 years, the question is not going to be why the United States invaded Iraq, why the United States invaded Afghanistan. The question that would basically fascinate historians is that why the American system of checks and balances failed after 9/11. Why? Because the American perspective was blinded by dust, by pain, by fear, by pride, and by revenge. And you have a small group of ideologues, regardless of their intentions, I'm not questioning their intentions, hijacked American foreign policy that basically brought us to where we are today. Al-Qaeda on 9/11 numbered between 1,000 and 2,000 fighters. The so-called Islamic State now numbers between 30 and 40,000 fighters. Al-Qaeda Central never occupied a small city in the world. The so-called Islamic State occupies a state in Syria and Iraq as big as the United Kingdom, where I am. They control the lives of 8 million people. They are culturally cleansing places all over Syria and Iraq. And there is a real potential that this particular state continues to be what it is, that this particular would turn from a, you might say, a regional problem challenge into a global one. So here you have where we were on 9/11 and where we are here in 2015.
That was Fawaz Geragos in London. His new book is called The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. Adil Najam of Boston University, back in our studio, just respond to that general notion that the game plan playing out in the world is still Al-Qaeda's and Osama bin Laden's, essentially.
I would put a little nuance to it. It's a game plan that was triggered by Al-Qaeda, but my gut instinct is that if Osama bin Laden was here, he would actually be surprised at ISIS and may actually not like them very much. Hmm. What we are seeing now is much more a child of Ayman al-Zawahiri's sort of intellectual idea than Osama bin Laden. And what I mean by that is what your first guest talked about. Osama bin Laden was really focused on the West. The Islamic State, or what's called the ISIL, or who call themselves the Islamic State, is calling itself that for one very good reason. They want this grand... their fight is within Islam. Their fight is with Islam. Their fight is with Muslims. They have a particular ideology. And so they are much less, I think, West-centric than Osama bin Laden was.
Well, that's an interesting detail inside their group. But we're still, it's not new that Osama bin Laden, his attack on 9/11 cost him roughly $500,000. We spent $5 trillion in response. We're still chasing their rabbit, so to speak.
We are certainly caught in Osama bin Laden's war. We are certainly caught in that confluence of events that was triggered, probably at a grander scale than even he ever imagined. And for us, I think, was exactly right that when history is written, it will be preoccupied not with the questions that we are preoccupied with today, but with this grand question of what happened to this greatest power on earth, the only superpower at this time, that it totally got blindsided by these men in caves.
And lost in, as he's saying, a constitutional rudder, in a sense, too. Before we're done, I want you to come back to this matter of imperial management. I'm thinking ahead from President Obama's gathering with the Arab chiefs last week at Camp David. Add Bibi Netanyahu and his new government in Israel. And I wonder, you know, with allies like these, don't we, in fact, keep multiplying our enemies? Saudi Arabia gets you the 9/11 hijackers, plus radical Wahhabi Islam and its missionaries. Pakistan gets you all the entanglements of their army with the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Isn't it time to reset these alliances?
I think that it is, but I would again question whether any of these are alliances. The real imperialist powers, the British, never called India their ally. They didn't call the countries they controlled in Africa their ally. They were much more honest about it. They said, "Your dominion."
Our queen is your empress.
Our queen is your empress. Our laws are your laws. And in some ways, I think maybe we need a little more honesty in this. What you're seeing is actually the crumbling of this, if they are alliances, but certainly the crumbling of these relationships, not just, Netanyahu and Obama, but this summit that you talk about was not really a summit. So
somebody said it was really an arms bazaar.
Well, it was an arms bazaar, but also Saudi Arabia didn't show up, or the king didn't show up. Some of the other leaders didn't show up. That would have been beyond imagination, and I think the world is, in fact, resetting. Unfortunately, I'm not sure it's resetting in ways that are desirable for us here or for the world itself.
Consider the reset. Our friend Steve Kinzer wrote an interesting book a few years ago, sort of have done with Saudi Arabia and Israel. Make an alliance, make a working alliance with Iran and Turkey for the future. But my real question, as things do get better with Iran, could that relationship get warm without taking on a lot of the comparable baggage?
Yeah, I hope it will, and I hope it does. In some ways, that is what the President Obama seems to be doing, both with Turkey, but certainly much more so with Iran. I think we need to rethink, your other guests have answered this question. We need to rethink the nature of these relationships. And in some ways, I think we need to be much more honest about the nature of these relationships. And that's going to be tough for us. Here's what I mean. You talked earlier about, this absurd relationship between Pakistan and the U.S. So if it is a bad marriage, as you call it, why doesn't one party just leave? Why doesn't someone call for divorce? Now, there is a reason. And the reason is that troubled as it is, cursed as it is, every alternative to that relationship is worse than where we are. And that's the that's the jam that both Pakistan and the U.S. are caught in. So
everything's worse, but not a relationship with China. I mean, yes, an imperial relationship, but it wouldn't be quite equal, but it would develop.
But
the territory.
But Pakistan doesn't see the relationship with China as an alternative to a relationship with the U.S., at least not at this point. So Pakistan has always seen China as a close friend. Remember when Henry Kissinger went to China?
Sure, he went through Pakistan.
He went through Pakistan. So Pakistan has found that role it can play as a very important one. But the point I'm making with the US-Pakistan relationship is, in some ways, you know, I would be much happier if it was more transactional.
It was
meaning here's what we want you to do.
Businesslike.
Much more businesslike, right? Much more contractual. Rather than wrapping these relationships around grand words of world peace and democracy and goodness and Hakuna Matata, and then not being able to deliver on that. That was the lesson that at least Pakistan learned from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and Pakistan's relationship with the U.S. after this. Mm. In some ways, I think if it was a more business-like relationship, not just with Pakistan, but with these other countries, we would be better off, they would be better off.
When do you declare the end of the military infatuation? We'll send you arms. The transaction is so often exclusively in arms, really.
It is. And I think one of your guests rightly pointed out, if that's the biggest hammer you have, you're going to use it again and again. It is, to be fair, also a language that many of these countries, including mine, understands much better. And again, to be fair, the fact certainly with Pakistan is because the military in Pakistan is so strong, even during non-military rule, maintaining that relationship is very important for any outside player and certainly for the U.S. So I'm agreeing, but I'm saying it isn't as easy as simply turning that off. But build more libraries, connect more with sort of cultural issues and people-to-people issues. Do things that ordinary people can see. The Chinese are smarter at that right now than the U.S. are. That's why they're building roads and dams and ports and railroads.
Yeah, or maybe I heard people say maybe an NFL franchise for Karachi.
Yes.
Or something.
Or maybe bring cricket to the U.S.
That's interesting. And then when we get some progress there, we'll sort of try to untangle the romance of a nuclear confrontation over a ridiculous border between Pakistan and India.
Yeah. This, I think, the lost opportunity has been, you know, after the end of the Cold War, many of us thought here was a great opportunity for the U.S., which wanted to get warmer relations with India, to use that to bring these two countries together. If anyone can, the U.S. could. And in some ways, I think we haven't even tried. Unfortunately, history sort of made the Afghanistan-Pakistan border so much more interesting for the outside world. But imagine a U.S.
But a phony. I mean, one of the things that Richard Holbrooke never persuaded anybody to do was to call it not AFPAC, but AFPAC, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India.
And
that's the story.
Right.
But the Indians don't want to be included.
Yeah. But imagine a U.S. diplomatic strategy where a major part of what it does in this region is to try to get better relations with India and Pakistan. It can, because it actually holds some sway over both. You know, not great, but India wants to be closer to it. Pakistan needs to be closer to it. Now, imagine that diplomacy. That's a very different world. It could lead to very different conclusions. In some ways, China is again playing more of that role, playing both with India and Pakistan because of its own economic interests, to bring them closer rather than to use them one against the other.
Yeah, we've both spoken about the absurdity on its face of this relationship and the securitized, militarized, lethal, destructive relationship. I begin to think that the only sort of event that will change it is the rise of China.
In some ways, it has already. So even U.S. interests in the region are now really clouded by what China does, not just in Pakistan. So what China is doing in Pakistan is not just about Pakistan, it's also about India. And therefore, it is about India's getting closer to the U.S. So geopolitics never leaves us for too long.
Adil Najam, it's a great pleasure to meet you on the radio. We're going to do this again. Thank you. Thanks also to Aisha Jalal, to Idris Ahmad, Bawaz Gerges, and Carlotta Gall of the New York Times. Her latest book, The Wrong Enemy, is now out in paperback. You can find a great game reading list, a sign up for our newsletter, and a series of Pakistan conversations on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our station chief. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.